Hello, you're listening to Sarah Jackman, presenting this week's episode of Bricks and Mortar. Today I'm talking to someone who is no stranger to the EG studio. He's a regular podcast host, EG's diary editor, and my colleague on the legal and professional desk. Yes, folks, it's Jess Harold, and today he's going to talk to me about judgments, what they are, how they're structured, and how you get what you need from them. Jess. Thank you very much indeed for agreeing to put yourself on the other side of the interview today. I can't think of anyone better placed to discuss judgments, having spent many years reporting from the Royal Courts of Justice, both for EG and other news organisations. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much. Very, very odd to be this side of the desk.
Promise to go easy on you. All right, to start us off, can you explain to our listeners what a judgment is?
Yes, I can. Well, hopefully. So basically, a judgment is the decision that the court makes following the trial of a legal dispute between opposing parties. When it comes to the kind of cases that we're primarily concerned with, property and planning disputes, judgments these days tend to be given in writing, usually within a few weeks of a case being heard, although it can take up to a few months in certain cases. They can vary in length, depending on the complexity of the case, the length of the trial, the amount of evidence, and so on. From just a few pages to something more like a novel. I should clarify that for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to be largely focusing on judgments from the High Court, Court of Appeal and Supreme Court. Other important judgments are given by the First Tier Tribunal, Upper Tribunal, Lands Chamber and County Courts up and down the country, which can differ in format, availability and so on. But we would be here all day if we tried to cover everything.
All right. Where would I find out when a judgment is due to be given?
Well, that is the question. So we don't always get as much notice as we might like, unless you're one of the parties to a case or their lawyers. At High Court level, the first we usually know of when a judgment is going to be given or handed down, to use the parlance, is the afternoon before, when what is known as the cause list or court list is published online. Now, you can find that at www.justice.gov.uk/courts/court-lists. It covers all the courts sitting at the Royal Courts of Justice and the Royals Building in London, as well as the various High Courts sitting in the regions. Most property cases at High Court level can be found in the Business and Property Courts Rolls Building cause list, bit of a mouthful, while the Royal Courts of Justice cause list includes the Planning Court, where judicial reviews involving planning are heard, and the Court of Appeal. Important property and planning cases regularly find their way to the Court of Appeal, so it's well worth keeping an eye on that list. With the Court of Appeal, you usually get a few extra days' notice of a looming judgment included in the list. And finally, the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, typically gives its judgments each Wednesday, although this does occasionally vary. You can keep track of cases before the Supreme Court at its website, www.supremecourt.uk, and by clicking on the latest news tab, you can usually find a list of the judgments scheduled for the next hand-down date. Typically, advance notice for each Wednesday gets published the previous Friday. Simple.
Okay, so I've tracked down the case that I want to hear judgment in. Can I attend court to hear it being delivered?
Yes, you absolutely can. Our court buildings are often splendid places to visit. But a little bit of a warning, attending the handing down of a judgment can sometimes be a little anticlimactic. More often than not, unless there's some argument to be had about costs or permission to appeal or some other matter, a judge will hand down judgment to a largely empty courtroom, save for the usher and the odd law reporter eager to get their hands on a copy as soon as possible. It's often not regarded as a good use of resources for expensive lawyers to attend court just for the handing down of a judgment that they have already received electronically. Another factor that can lead to disappointment if you attend court is that you might not even get your hands on a copy of the judgment. Financial and environmental concerns mean that long gone are the days where you could count on piles of copies being available in every court. More often than not now, the best and fastest way to get a judgment is online. For very important or significant cases, there can still be some excitement to have or a sense of occasion about being present as judgment is formally handed down and perhaps history is made. In such cases, it is not wholly unusual for the judge or judges to give a short oral summary, setting out the key facts of the case, the major issues involved and their decision. Attending the Supreme Court is also an option, though it is not nearly as impressive a day out as when it was the House of Lords sitting in the Palace of Westminster. Thankfully, the Supreme Court makes things fantastically easy by live streaming hearings and judgment handdowns on its website and making those judgments available immediately for download.
Okay, then. So if I do want to get hold of a written copy of the judgment, where do I need to go?
So first of all, a fairly reliable source for transcripts of most property and planning related cases, I should say, is the EG website itself. Just click on that legal tab, which I'm sure you've all got bookmarked, and scroll down the black bars until you get to transcripts. Our case summarisers are monitoring various sources to bring you relevant judgments, usually the same day they're handed down, or as soon as possible thereafter. If you're trying to track down a past judgment, the search facility should help you find it. If it's a property case from the last few decades, chances are that we do have it. In addition, there's a brilliant free resource provided by the British and Irish Legal Information Institute, BAILII for short, and that is B-A-I-L-I-I. Judgments are uploaded in huge numbers each day at its website, www.bailii.org, and there is, of course, a searchable archive. And once again, the Supreme Court is a special case. The best and fastest way to find their judgments is on the Supreme Court website.
Okay. Now, in my experience, judgments can be quite long, particularly where several judges are giving their opinion. Is there a set format that judgments take that make it easy to interpret?
Well, they do vary, and yes, you are right, some do get very long. So I've brought an example with me from a case that was named as one of our top 10 of 2019. Ah. Number two, in fact, you may remember, Fern versus Tate Gallery. It's a case I've selected because it gives a good example of how judgments can be structured. It's also rather timely because an appeal in the case is due to be heard next week. Now, this is one of those fairly long judgments. It comes in at 71 pages, so there's a fair amount to absorb.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I mean, is that fairly typical? What do you commonly see when you're wading through judgments in terms of length?
That is on the longer side. I would say that's an example of a case where there's been a lot of witness evidence and there's a lot of material to cover. I would say you would more typically expect 10 double-sided pages, 10 to 20 double-sided pages, I would say, in the ordinary run-of-the-mill case. Mm-hmm. Although, because a lot of important cases in our area do get quite technical and quite detailed, then perhaps we get to enjoy longer judgments more often than many people do.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted
you. No, that's quite all right. Oh, I should just say that you can obtain a copy of Fern if you want to look at it along with us as we're doing this. We've included the link on the website and the podcast description, so you can find it at our site or on BAILII. Well, first things first, the title page is hugely important. It tells you the court that has given judgment and the name of the judge or judges involved. It gives you the date of the judgment and also the all-important citation, which we'll talk about later on. It also has the name of the case, which takes the form of the claimant, the party that has brought the claim, versus the defendant, the party that is defending the claim. It will usually list by name all the parties involved, if there are multiple claimants, multiple defendants, or other interested parties, as well as identifying the barristers and solicitors that represented all of them. It's very good advice to pay clear attention to who exactly is the claimant and who is the defendant, which helps you keep track of what's going on, and most importantly, who has won. If it is an appeal judgment rather than claimant and defendant, the parties will instead be referred to as appellant and respondent. The appellant is the one bringing the appeal, and the respondent, as you might imagine, is responding to it. Once you've absorbed all that, it's time to look at the judgment itself. And in the case of our example, Fern, it comes in at 71 pages, so there's a lot to absorb. Thankfully, the judge has broken it down into sections that help you navigate your way through it. Back when I started out as a legal journalist, which was rather too long ago than I care to remember, you couldn't always rely on judges taking that kind of methodical approach. But nowadays, it is fairly standard. Typically, you do get a short introduction setting the scene for the case, outlining the background facts and the issues raised, such as the type of claim being brought and under what legislation, etc. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you might get a judge prepared to have a bit of fun in this section, quoting Shakespeare or some other literary source, or injecting a splash of colour. In this example, there is a small bit of colour. The case involved neighbouring residents to the Tate Modern objecting about a new viewing platform that, as well as panoramic views of London, offers perfect sightlines straight into their luxury flats. So the judge begins by saying, "This is a case brought in nuisance and under the Human Rights Act 1998 to protect what are said to be rights of privacy," before injecting in brackets, "putting it loosely." To offer another recent example, the judgment in a case involving Berkeley Square began with the observation that there is no reliable ornithological evidence to the effect that nightingales have ever sung there. Beyond that occasional flourish of entertainment, the introduction is vital reading to understand what the case is all about. The judge will then typically go into much more detail on the facts and the history between the parties. If there's been witness evidence in the case, as was very much the case in Fern, the judge might go through the runners and riders and what they've had to say for themselves. Other sections may include the judge's impressions on key witnesses, conclusions on any factual matters in dispute, and so on. And then move to consideration of the grounds of claim raised and the issues of law they involve. Again, these do now tend to be dealt with separately under subheadings. So if you're looking at a case specifically to find what a judge has to say on a particular issue, you can usually navigate your way through the pages, checking the subheadings to see if you can find what you're looking for. As an example, in Fern, one of the key questions was whether the Tate Gallery is a public authority, thus opening it up to a claim under the Human Rights Act. Helpfully, at paragraph 121, the judge has inserted the subheading, "Is the Tate Gallery a public authority?" Browse through the six paragraphs in that section, you'll get your answer. Spoiler alert, it is not. Pending, that is, any contrary decision of the Court of Appeal, if that ground is pursued. On major grounds, such as the nuisance claim in Fern, the judge will likely outline each party's arguments, also a useful section worth looking out for. Then, any section that begins with the word conclusion or conclusions is well worth a look. And in Fern, we have an overall conclusion paragraph. This is where you will usually find the result, where the claim is typically dismissed or allowed. There can be shades of grey, but we won't go into that here. Chances are you'll be dealing with a straightforward allowed or dismissed case. And in Fern, we see, at paragraph 224, that it was dismissed. A useful lesson Fern offers is that, while this conclusion is 9 times out of 10 at the very end, it isn't always. Here, we have a postscript to keep us on our toes if we've tried to flip to the end to see if the butler did do it. We have to put in a little bit more work than that. One more tip that Fern offers is that sometimes a judgment can have an absolute standout line buried deep within it. So here, in paragraph 214, the judge considers some of the remedial steps that the residents could have taken to protect themselves from being gawked at by tourists at the Tate Modern. One of which is that these owners of very des reses in a prime area of London could install net curtains. A very welcome suggestion, I'm sure. Perhaps the best example of this kind of hidden gem was in the judgment dismissing a breach of copyright claim over the best-selling Da Vinci Code novel. Mr. Justice Peter Smith inserted his own code into the text via italicised letters. So, if you do have time to thoroughly dissect a judgment, you never know what you might find.
Okay. I mean, that's incredibly helpful. I remember the first time I picked up a judgment and really looking at it in its entirety. It is quite difficult to know where to start.
It's a lot to take in at first glance. And obviously, you know, it covers many very technical areas. And, having a kind of basic understanding of the anatomy of the judgment and sort of getting to grips with that idea that actually you don't really always have to read every word to understand what's going on. I think that's useful.
Mm. Okay. And I'm interested in this point that you make at the end here about there being an absolute standout somewhere buried beneath the confusion.
Yeah,
that's
probably
somewhere.
Me looking at it more with a journalistic eye than necessarily a surveyor or other property professional who's out there to sort of get a crucial idea of what the law is and how best to operate. But it's always, it's entertaining when you can find something that adds a bit of colour.
Just brings it to life. Yeah. And how can I find an abridged version of the judgment somewhere? Is there one?
There isn't always, unfortunately. It's definitely something that if there was one thing, and there are many, many things I'd like to do to improve the court process, but one thing I would very much like for the courts to introduce is a one-page summary for every decision. But some judges are better than others at doing that, and unsurprisingly, where it is done, it's usually found at the back. But one thing that you sort of learn by sort of looking at judgments is that quite often cases are more complicated than a straightforward win or lose. So if a case raises a number of issues, it can be quite tricky to kind of discern on which grounds either a claimant has been successful or unsuccessful. So it has become more common over the last few years for judges to include a more accessible summary. And once again, the Supreme Court very much leads the way on making this kind of thing easy to understand. When it publishes its judgment, it also puts out a press summary. Mm-hmm. This is a vital tool for us journalists, but it is also useful for property professionals and members of the public looking to get a grasp of major decisions. It sets out, typically in two pages, the facts of the case and what the court has decided. And best of all, it refers expressly to paragraph numbers in the actual judgment, so you can see the headlines of what the court has decided, but then turn straight to the actual judgment and see how the justices of the Supreme Court have addressed the major issues in their own words, which can be much more enlightening than the summary.
And in some judgments, you may have dissenting judgments. What does that mean?
This happens at appellate level, where cases are heard by a panel of judges rather than a single judge. So at the Court of Appeal, cases are typically heard by three judges, while the Supreme Court usually sits in panels of five, though for really big cases that number can be higher. Most judgments are unanimous, i.e. all the judges agree on the point, or on the decision, rather. And usually one of them writes the main judgment. This wasn't always the way back in the House of Lords days. You would quite often get five judges all notionally agreeing, all writing individual judgments on the topic. However, yeah, nowadays it's mostly one writes the main judgment. But just like with anything, our finest legal minds can't always agree on every outcome. And when that happens, it is a case of majority wins. So 2 out of 3 at the Court of Appeal, or 4-1, or even 3-2 at the Supreme Court. So there have been cases where one side has been successful all the way through, High Court, unanimous at the Court of Appeal, gets to the Supreme Court and loses by the slimmest majority. So what that means is there would have been 6 judges agreeing with you, 3 judges disagreeing with you, and yet you lose. But that is unfortunately the way the cookie crumbles in our system. Now, where you have one of these judgments where 1 or 2 judges disagree with the overall outcome, they will write a dissenting judgment. And that's where they set out their reasons for how they would have decided the case differently. Complicating matters further still, you do get cases where still different judges reach the same overall conclusion, but for different reasons. Then they will offer separate opinions in the judgment. This probably doesn't bother the successful party, who is just happy with the win. But it can cause a bit of a headache for anyone wanting to apply the decision to future cases, trying to work out which reasoning offers the better view of how the law really works.
Another form of judgment that people might come across is a separate ruling relating to costs. What form does a cost judgment typically take?
The usual rule is that costs follow the event, people mm-hmm. say. Costs follow the event. So that means the loser pays the winner's legal costs, which sounds nice and simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, it is. But such is the nature of legal costs that in some cases, it can actually become the most important battleground. It can be that the cost of the action far outstrips the value of whatever the parties were fighting about. I mean, some of the best examples of that are neighbours at loggerheads over where the boundary between their property lies. And you can plenty of examples of appellate judges pulling their wigs out over people spending hundreds of thousands of pounds over a strip of land that to anyone else is effectively worthless. Mm. Or you can have a case that's gone through a lengthy trial and then an appeal, and the cost of the many hours involved by specialists and expensive lawyers, it can really mount up. So as a result, sometimes a further dispute, once a judgment has been handed down, arises over just how much should be paid by one party to the other. Now, a typical cost dispute might arise if the successful party pursued a large number of grounds of claim, but only got home on 1 or 2. Should they really get every penny back when, on an issue-by-issue basis, the overall loser of the war might actually have won quite a few key battles along the way? Also, in some cases, one party might have offered to settle the case at an early stage well before it went to trial, for some that ends up higher than the amount of damages the successful party received. Mm-hmm. So that can also have consequences for the final costs order in the case. So these and other scenarios can lead the party's lawyers to enter into fresh argument about the final cost bill. Now, in some cases, this is dealt with by the judge in oral argument immediately following the hand down of the judgment. The judge may then make a fairly swift judgment on, for instance, the percentage of one party's costs that the other should have to pay. Mm-hmm. Might make a discount, 20% for an issue that the unsuccessful party actually won on. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. But if the cost argument is particularly complicated, this then might have to be handled in a separate written decision, which then is handed down in a similar way, usually very short, only a few pages, handed down sort of some weeks after the main action. And often at the same time, one or in the best cases, even both parties might actually seek to appeal a decision. They might ask the judge for permission to take the case on to the Court of Appeal. So then at the same hearing as the cost argument, you might get the parties seeking to persuade the judge that there's an important point of law or mm-hmm. some other compelling reason why the case should go further. And all these matters might be dealt with in one sort of ancillary judgment following the main action. Now, once a decision has been made on the principle of costs, i.e. if it is loser pays or if it is loser pays 80% or whatever it is, the judge typically invites the parties to agree the final sum between them. And if they can't do that, the figures do go under the detailed scrutiny of a specialist cost judge, which adds yet more complexity to the whole process.
And presumably cost.
I believe so, yes.
All right. Occasionally, one might see a judgment being listed as extemporaneous. What does that mean?
It means legal journalists break out in a cold sweat. It's a posh word for readout. It's a posh word for readout. So, thankfully, this does not happen nearly as often as it used to in property cases at the High Court and Court of Appeal, at least. Back when I started out, far too long ago in the early 2000s, it would be a fairly regular occurrence to attend an ex temp judgment where the judge basically sits and reads out the whole thing. I mean, everything that you would find in a written judgment, the judge would read the whole thing. I've been to judgments that take virtually the entire day in my time. So, I mean, that process did have an obvious advantage for the parties because it meant they would get a quicker decision, mm-hmm. Often as quick as the day after or even the day of the hearing of the case. I do fondly remember an expert planning judge called he became Lord Justice Sullivan, who I had the immense pleasure of interviewing when he retired. But back when he was Mr. Justice Sullivan, sitting in the administrative court, as it was then, hearing planning case after planning case, you could rely on him any time you went to his court, which was usually Court 27, and were told that a case had a time estimate of 2 days, then you could be absolutely certain that the second afternoon would be spent sat in Court 27 scribbling away as Mr. Justice Sullivan gave his judgment. And he had, for some bizarre reason that I could never fathom, he had a remarkable fondness for giving judgment at 3 p.m. on a Friday afternoon when nobody except him wanted to be there. Thankfully, not many judges now share his passion for extemporising, and thankfully almost all judgments of any real interest are delivered in writing, usually, as I said earlier, a few weeks or even months after the trial. So apart from nostalgic warmth towards Lord Justice Sullivan, this, in my opinion, is a far better system. It allows judgments to be much more carefully considered and clearly written. It thereby avoids confusion or misunderstanding, and not least by those of us furiously noting down complicated legal language in shorthand.
Yeah, I can well imagine. Just thinking then of various ways in which you might hear a case referred, what's the difference between a judgment, a law report and a case summary?
So, as we've mentioned, judgments can be very, very long, so 71 pages in the case of Fern, and often quite difficult to understand for anyone who's not well-versed in the process. And they can contain an awful lot of material that isn't necessarily directly relevant to someone just wanting to try and understand what's been decided and why. But thankfully, there are experts who summarise decisions in case summaries and law reports, picking out the key issues and findings. There are many different services out there. If anyone listening has studied law at any point or had cause to look into the field, they will know that whole libraries can be filled with bound volumes of law reports going back centuries. But to concentrate on our case summaries and law reports, that's the Estates Gazette Law Reports, or EGLR as they are known, the summaries go online very quickly, often the same day or next day as the judgment is given. And they set out very clearly the case name, the date of decision, the court, the judge or judges, and in a set of keywords at the top, the type of dispute, and a very brief outline of what has been decided. There's then a fuller explanation of the decision, highlighting earlier case precedents that the court has applied. So these are very useful for getting in a single page a good grasp of what has been decided. And now we maintain a massive archive of case summaries online and print two in issues of EG throughout most of the year. And, you know, several of those do go up every week during court terms. Our law reports do follow a similar format, but they're greatly expanded with the full text of the judgment itself, as edited by our team, which also incorporates links to our previous summaries and law reports for cases that have been referred to by the court in each case. So we reserve these EGLRs for the most significant cases and typically publish between 50 and 60 a year online. Now, dusty bound volumes of these do exist in certain law libraries for older cases, but our extensive archive online goes all the way back to 1975, which should do for most jobs, I think.
All right. Both judgments and law reports are given citations to help identify them. Can you explain for our listeners what's a citation and what form do they take?
So basically, it's a system used that allows people to identify judgments. You can, going by case name alone, you know, you can, confusion can come in. You get cases that sound quite similar. Like the best example, I think, at the moment is flood of telecoms cases in the upper tribunal. Half of all cases involve Cornerstone Telecommunications Infrastructure Limited. And yeah. So having a citation means you can easily catalogue cases and find them and everyone knows what you're referring to, or everyone can look up what you're referring to. Yeah. And be sure that everyone's singing from the same law report. So the official or neutral citation from the court is found usually at the top of the judgment, just under the court system logo. So for our Fern example, it is square brackets 2019 close square brackets EWHC